Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Associate Professor Kaelin Davenport, head of the Centre for Classical Studies at the Australian National University. This is episode CCXII, Aurelian, the Restorer of the World. Aurelian became emperor of a fractured Roman Empire. To the west, the Gallic Empire had been established 10 years earlier, the eastern provinces were now controlled by Zenobia, and there were threats from the Vandals in the north. To unite an empire, this will be the first priority. Here's Kaelin Davenport.
Aurelian was a military officer who became emperor in September of 270. So his full Roman name was Lucius Domitius Aurelianus. He's probably in his mid to late 50s by now, and had had a military career in the Roman army, had been a cavalry commander under Claudius Gothicus. He probably came from the area around Sirmium himself, so he was another of these Danubian soldiers who became emperor. And he does have a wife about whom virtually nothing is known beyond her name, Ulpia Severina. We're not sure when they married, probably before he became emperor. We know nothing about children as well. That's a big mystery.
Okay, but what we do know about this emperor is quite a lot of his immediate background because he's been closely associated with the campaigns of the previous two emperors.
Yes.
So is that right, the previous two, or does it go back further than that?
Well, certainly the HA has an invented backstory. but we can place him in the central command corps under both Gallienus and Claudius Gothicus, so throughout the 260s. Mm. And this is, you know, what is becoming increasingly important during this period is to be on the scene when an emperor dies, so you can be proclaimed by the troops.
And that's what happens in this case.
Yes, exactly. So Claudius dies of the plague in Sirmium. This is the plague of Cyprian. And then Aurelian is proclaimed emperor by the troops. Zonarus, who is our later Byzantine source from the 12th century, says he was designated the next emperor by Claudius Gothicus. The chronology is difficult to determine because, of course, Claudius's brother Quintilius was proclaimed emperor by the Senate in Italy, but he only reigns for 17 days before committing suicide or being murdered. We don't know what happens. And certainly Aurelian does march to Aquileia, where he finds that Quintilius has died, so, you know, he's now unopposed as emperor. And then he marches a bit further south to Ravenna, which is a port town in north Italy on the Adriatic. It's where Rome's Adriatic fleet is based.
Okay, okay. So he's pretty much gathering all the military behind him as he goes, by the sounds of it.
Yes, yes, exactly. So you want to pick up the troops that were commanded by the rival emperor and make sure that they're on your side.
So he's heading towards Rome at this point, and if I was Rome, if I was the senators, I would be nervous because they backed Quintilius in this instance, who was very much the losing man very quickly.
Yes, so there is clear tension between Aurelian and the Senate, apparent very early on. So it's actually at Ravenna that he's met by a delegation of senators from Rome. So they actually take the initiative and don't wait for him to come to them. Now, the anonymous continuator of Cassius Dio, who's a contemporary source that survives only in fragments, records some of this meeting. This is fragment 10.1. Now, apparently, Aurelian tells the assembled senators he's hoping to be greater even than Claudius Gothicus. And one senator says to him, and I quote, "If you want to rule nobly, fortify yourself with gold and iron, the iron against those who discomfort you, the gold for those who do you service." And in the way anecdote plays out is that the senator who said this is the first one to feel the iron. So he is actually banished and executed by Aurelian at some point early on in the reign.
It sounds like he was asking for a handout, that guy.
Well, certainly, yes. I'm going to do service, so reward us with gold. That's the idea.
Not a head off. Right, okay.
Yeah, so there's different chronologies here. So one version is that Aurelian does actually go to Rome after this and spends the winter of 270, 271 in Rome. Another version is that he actually goes from Ravenna straight to Pannonia.
Mm-hmm.
So if he does go to Rome, this may have been when he cancelled all debts. So this was a very common thing to do when an emperor came to power, to cancel all outstanding debts to the treasury. They usually hold a nice bonfire in the city of Rome where the debt records are incinerated for all eternity. So that's a good way to win popularity. And he's also supposed to have issued an amnesty for all senators who were exiled by his predecessors. So that was also a good way to win favour.
But you said there's that or Pannonia. So what's in Pannonia?
So in Pannonia, there's an invasion of the Vandals. And he certainly does go there in 271. So this is the first time we're really meeting the Vandals. They are known in the first century AD as a Germanic tribe. Pliny the Elder mentions them in his Natural History. And they are part of the confederation of German tribes that invades the empire in the reign of Marcus Aurelius. But this is the first significant mention of the Vandals in the 3rd century, and they will play an increasingly important role in the breakup of the Roman Empire in the 5th century.
Their reputation even today, Vandal is synonymous with a place being trashed or...
Exactly. Yeah. Vandalism comes from the Vandals, yes, and their sackings of Rome, so...
And the Vandals sit back and go, look, that was one time.
Yes, exactly, and then, you know, it lives in all memory, yes.
Wow, okay, all right. So he journeys to Pannonia to confront these Vandals.
Yes, and we know he's victorious because we actually now have a fragment of Dexippus, our contemporary author, this fragment that survives, fragment 7, which tells us that the Vandals sent an embassy to Aurelian to ask for a peace treaty. However, the talks break down, Dexippus tells us. So Aurelian takes the advice of his army. And I will now read a quote from Dexippus. On the next day, all the Roman troops were assembled once again, and the emperor asked what they thought was the best policy under the current circumstances. Looking to safeguard their present good luck by making the preservation of their resources their first consideration, they made their wishes clear by acclamation and called as one for an end to the war. So Aurelian does make a peace treaty, and this involves the Vandal kings giving hostages. I'll read further from Dexippus fragment 7. The barbarian kings and their officers, once they're apprised of this, gave hostages from their own households, not hostages whom they had taken in turn by order or by lottery. For each of the kings gave his own sons for inclusion amongst the hostages without a moment's hesitation, while others immediately offered hostages to them too, without any further request. Accordingly, they reached an agreement and peace was established. The terms were that 2,000 Vandal horsemen would fight alongside the Romans. Some of these would be elite troops chosen for the alliance from the larger army, while others were volunteers willing to put themselves under Roman military authority.
Wow.
So this is something we find happening increasingly in the 3rd century as part of these treaties between Rome and Germanic tribes, is that the Romans acknowledge that they're excellent warriors. So they bring some of these Germanic tribes onto their side to serve in the Roman army, thus, you know, helping to build bonds of loyalty between both sides.
Does it have something to do with the fact as well that, I mean, it's been such an attrition kind of environment for the last 50-odd years, especially when you're losing the western side of the empire, you're losing the eastern side of the empire, you're losing army in both those instances, and you need fresh men at some point to do all this fighting that you're meant to be doing.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point. You know, the losses, you know, for example, in, you know, Valerian's battle against Shapur, which we know he drew forces from the Rhine and Danube frontiers, were catastrophic. So yes, it's a way of replenishing Rome's own forces too.
And you've got plague.
Yes, that has been killing people as well, so for the past 20 years. So it's a very good sound strategic decision.
So yes, we can use some Vandals. Okay. So we're not told anything about the military exchange here, but it's clearly happened.
Mm.
The terms, they do accept the terms.
Mm.
And so it's, I just referenced a 70-year-old movie.
I'm not sure what.
Sorry, that just triggered a Danny Kaye movie somewhere in the back of my mind.
Oh, my goodness, right, yeah, okay.
All right, anyway, and so what does Aurelian do at this point? So he's got this victory here. Would he take a name for this?
No, he didn't take a name for this victory. He's not Vandalicus Maximus or anything like that. He's only, again, Germanicus Maximus. Okay. So he takes that, you know, because they're German tribes, but we don't have a Vandalicus Maximus, for example.
Okay, all right. So he's defeated these Vandals. He's come to terms with them. And where's the next front that he's heading to?
Well, he has to move to Italy. And Dexippus tells us because the Euthungi have moved into Roman territory in North Italy. Italy while he's been fighting the Vandals.
Okay, so they've been opportunistic at this point.
Exactly.
They've been an issue before?
Yes. So, for example, in 260, when Valerian is off in the east, you know, there's this catastrophic battle against Shapur, a group of Euthungi and Semnones cross into Raetia, which is sort of modern-day Switzerland, Austria, and they're fought off by the acting governor and local militia as well. So they have been a problem before. And of course, you know, now when Aurelian's off in Pannonia, they've crossed the Alps into North Italy again, and they're threatening Milan.
Okay. All right. They're right on Italy's doorstep at this point.
Very much so.
So Aurelian goes across to confront them.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, the story of Aurelian's reign is crisscrossing across the empire really quickly.
Yeah.
So he goes to North Italy. By the time he gets there, they've besieged and sacked the town of Placentia. Once again, thankfully, we have a contemporary source. The anonymous continuator of Cassius Dio comes to our reference, fragment 10.3. Aurelian, when he had learned that a detachment of barbarians was in Placentia, declared to them, "If you wish to do battle, behold, I am ready. But if you reckon the better course to surrender yourselves, I receive you as your master." And they declared in turn, "We have no master. On the morrow, prepare yourself and learn that you fight against free men." Obviously, this is, again, rather dramatic. You know, it has all these great themes of, you know, liberty and slavery. And once again, you know, Aurelian is a megalomaniac, you know, wanting everyone to bow down before him. Now, in reality, we know that Aurelian is caught off guard and is ambushed by the Euthungi south of Placentia. Now, there's panic in Rome that the Euthungi are actually going to make it as far as the capital. It seems at this point there may have been some revolts in Rome, or beginning of revolts in Rome, which we'll talk about very soon. So what happens is that Aurelian meets the Euthungi in battle near the town of Farnum Fortunae, the Shrine of Fortune, which is on the Adriatic coast. And this is near a river, the Metaurus River. Aurelian uses the land to his advantage. He forces the enemy back into the river, where many of them drowned. And we know that this victory was celebrated by local towns. In nearby Pizarum, there are statues dedicated to the eternal victory of Aurelian and to Hercules Augustus, the partner of Aurelian.
Wow. Wait, who's Hercules Augustus?
It's Hercules as the emperor.
Right. That's just his day job.
Yeah, yes. Hero, emperor. <Okay. laughs> Now we have an insight into what happens in the aftermath of this battle, thanks again to Dexippus, and this is fragment 6. Now what actually happens, Dexippus tells us, is the Euthungi, even though they've been defeated, still want to be paid to go away and leave North Italy.
Despite the fact that they were pushed back into a river.
Yes.
Okay.
Many of them drowned.
It's not a great negotiating foot to start on.
Well, basically, Dexippus tells us it's because this is what they've always expected, and so they expect the Romans to cough up funds regardless, because, you know, they're still in North Italy,
yeah.
You know, which is the heartland of the empire, and can still, you know, in limited numbers, inflict considerable damage on the towns, their populations.
So it's like somebody coming over, being a pain in the ass, and then trying to bum the taxi fare home.
Exactly, exactly.
I don't like them.
No. Neither does Aurelian. Dexippus tells us that Aurelian goes for intimidation.
Yeah.
So Dexippus says, he found the units arranged to his satisfaction and mounted a high speaker's platform. And then, donning a purple robe, Aurelian arranged the entire force around him in a crescent. He also placed beside him any officers who had been placed in any command, all of them on horseback. Behind the emperor were the standards of the elite units, golden eagles, images of the emperor, and plaques showing the names of the units picked out in gold letters, all held aloft and displayed on poles sheathed in silver. With everything so arranged, he ordered the Yuthungi to enter. The ambassadors, when they beheld this spectacle, were struck dumb with astonishment.
That's really cool. That'd make a good painting.
Oh, if only someone had painted that. Well, it gives you, the image of, the finery of the legions, all their standards with their names and, Aurelian sitting in splendour at the centre. Then Dexippus gives us two speeches, one by the ambassador, one by Aurelian. So the Yuthungi still demand gold, both minted and bullion, they say, and silver, just as they have usually received.
Yeah, see, the Romans have set precedent at this point. They're too used to it, these Junguthi.
Yes, but Aurelian says, no way. For if you are genuine in advocating peace, why on earth would you add a request for money? He goes on, tells them that, we've won triumphs against the Goths and the Alemanni in recent years. He tells them they're actually trapped inside Roman territory. And so the Yuthungi have to go home empty-handed. Now they go northwards back towards the Alps, and Aurelian follows them all the way. And then, outside Ticinum, which is modern-day Pavia, near Milan, he defeats them in battle. And so Yuthungi have learned their lesson.
Yeah, okay. And now he gets his title that you spoke of before.
Yeah, probably Germanicus Maximus at this point.
The way that we're told this story, the Junguthi seem to be an annoyance more than anything.
Mm.
But that's because we're only hearing about mostly the aftermath of the negotiations of this battle.
Yes, and we're hearing, once they were actually defeated. So at the time, it must have been really quite frightening to have them moving their way through rich agricultural land in North Italy. This is where senators, have residences, let alone the local people, who are kind of subsistence living.
You said they sacked towns on the way and everything. And yes. Then you alluded to as well, the fear made its way all the way to Rome.
Yes, exactly. And this is problematic for Aurelian because there are people there that may want to take charge instead. Now, there were two revolts that happen in Rome about this time that may or may not be connected. The first is that there are revolts by senators, as well as some governors in the provinces. Aurelius Victor and other sources also tell us about a revolt of the mint workers. And this was led by a man named Felicissimus.
The lucky one?
The lucky one, yeah, most lucky. Mr. Lucky Pants or something like that.
Mr. Lucky Pants.
he has been a bit naughty. He's been debasing the coinage, so filing down the coinage so it has less silver in it and then taking the remainders for himself and his cronies. And they're worried of being discovered when Aurelian comes back to Rome. So they stage revolt, and they gather on the Caelian Hill where the mint is, and they wage war with the urban cohorts. That results in the death of about 7,000 people.
Is that number accurate, or is that number, old text?
It's difficult to know. Okay. 7,000. Sevens is a very common number in Roman battles.
7,000 is a huge number of people to die in a Roman riot.
Yeah, yes, exactly. But, if this is perhaps connected with a senatorial revolt, that may lead further credence to these figures. And it seems that when Aurelian then returns to Rome, he puts down these revolts, showing no mercy. Yeah. And this becomes a hallmark of his reign. But he also takes steps to ensure that this does not happen again in the sense of the people of Rome being terrified at the thought of invasion. So he begins the construction of what we call the Aurelian Walls.
Okay. So this is a big step here, and it's quite an event for there to be, a riot of this scale as well. So how justified was this fear in Rome, and how undefended is it
Well, there had been a similar incident under Gallienus. We're talking, you know, about 10 years before here. So it's, you know, the second time in a decade. And Rome doesn't have proper walls surrounding its entire circuit at the moment.
It's been so big and comfortable for so long with this big buffer of an empire and this mighty army crisscrossing the empire, defending all the fronts, that I guess it hasn't needed to. It's comfortable. It's outgrown its walls.
That's right, yes. So there's the Servian walls. So they're ascribed to the king Servius Tullius, but they're actually built in the early Republic, probably in the 4th century BC.
600 years earlier.
Exactly. And it only covers, you know, the central area, basically rings most of the important hills. And so Rome has now far outstripped this on all sides, particularly the whole area of the Campus Martius, you know, which is now built up with monuments like, you know, the Pantheon and the Column of Marcus Aurelius, etc. All that lies outside the walls.
Yeah, I remember when Augustus built there, it was a big deal to be building that far out of Rome.
That's right.
Sorry, remember, like I was there, but
I remember when Augustus said, yes. Yeah, so there's 14 regions of Rome, and many of them now lie outside the walls, also the land across the Tiber. So the city is essentially a sitting duck, as it were, for invading Germanic tribes. So Aurelian begins the construction of these walls, which will now take in the majority of the inhabited areas of Rome, and they will be new walls, not 700-year-old walls.
And these walls will take the rest of his reign to construct, possibly into the next reign.
Yeah,
as well,
so they won't be finished when he dies. They'll be completed by Probus, who reigns between 276 and 282.
With the riot dealt with and him being proactive in protecting Rome, this is a man of action. This is a military man. He's looking for the next front that he's going to move to.
Exactly. The Goths are back in the Danubian region. By 272, he's on the march again. He defeats them in battle and takes the title Gothicus Maximus. However, in the aftermath of this, Aurelian takes a momentous decision. And this is because there's been such pressure on the Danubian front that he decides that it can't all be defended. So what he does is he abandons the Roman province of Dacia, which lies on the other side of the Danube, which was founded by Trajan about 150 years before.
Yeah.
So he withdraws the troops, the legions that were stationed there, saying it's just too much territory for us to defend. Withdrawing to the other side of the Danube means that the river is now this natural frontier. But in order to prevent this looking like a defeat, Aurelian creates a new province, Dacia Rapensis. So Dacia along the riverbanks.
Okay, so he gives way to marketing.
yes, exactly. It sounds rather nice, actually. On the southern side of the frontier. And he does this, you know, to strengthen this territory, because what he needs to do is he needs to go now to the east, where Zenobia, who's the widow of Septimius Odenathus, the Palmyrene leader, has now set herself up as a queen.
Mm. Okay, can we backtrack
just
to the Dacia on the river? Mm. So does this action make the frontier easier to defend?
It does in a sense, because you don't need to worry about territory on the other side. I mean, Dacia is a huge province. It consists of three mini provinces inside one. It does not have, you know, a wall that surrounds it, for example, like Hadrian's Wall or the Antonine Wall or some of the fortifications we see in Germany. The river is a much more defensible barrier.
Okay.
It is a major loss for the Romans, you know, because, you know, Dacia is a three-legion consular province, you know, governed by ex-consuls. It's a prestigious command. But increasingly, the emperors are having to take vexillations, so these detachments from legions for their field army on campaign, which weakens the forces within the province itself. So it's an acknowledgement of reality that it's not easy to defend.
No, I'm not criticizing it.
No,
it's a very practical decision, which I would have thought a Roman emperor would have been too proud to make.
Yeah, I think he's being pragmatic. It's much more important to him to reconquer the east from Zenobia.
Fair enough, yeah.
She also invades Egypt as well. Mm. That's really crucial.
That was Associate Professor Kaelin Davenport, Head of the Centre for Classical Studies at the Australian National University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, please subscribe on any readily available and friendly podcasting platform. Reviews are always appreciated, and hey, tell a friend about it. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter while it still exists. Kaelin is at Dr. C. Davenport, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. This podcast was recorded in Canberra and produced at La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia, on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, we take the story out to the east and look at the rule of Zenobia. So until then, I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.